Freely he preached the gospel at great cost to himself. Now the cost, boy, pencils are burning. The cost is expressed by the two words labor and travail. Now the word labor is the strongest word for labor in the New Testament, kapon. Comes from kapos, K-O-P-O-N. Kapon means to strike a blow, literally. To strike a blow. I mean, it means to really take one on the kisser or upside the head. Then the word comes to mean the effects of being, of taking one upside the jaw. It's Muhammad Ali and Ron Merriman in the ring. And Muhammad Ali connect. It's not Muhammad Ali, it's Joe Frazier. Muhammad Ali doesn't punch as hard as Joe Frazier. It's Joe Frazier striking a blow. Well, then the word comes to mean the effects of that. It means to be exhausted. It means to suffer wearisome effects of toil. Wearisome effects of toil. Now, you can have wearisome effects of toil simply by working hard. Maybe it's a motor type thing. I used to dig ditches in Florida, in coral rock, with a jackhammer. And in some cases, when we dug telephone post holes, we didn't have those big augers that they have now. You know, turn the motor on. 10 guys stand around and watch while the motor drills the hole. We had a bar, a digging bar, and we had those little post hole things to dig a telephone pole hole in coral rock. My hands were like rocks. I weighed 160 pounds. I had a job in the evening washing dishes, and they gave me my supper meal. And here I was outside all day, mixing concrete. Then I run and get on a bus, and run to the YMCA, take a shower, get on a bus, right out to my job. And I'm out in that Florida air all the time. I'm starved, you know. So I only had that job for 3 weeks. I ate too much. Well, I forgot to tell you, the job only paid 50 cents an hour to wash the dishes, plus my meal. So on the fringe benefit, I sort of concentrated on the meal. Then I had another snack before I went home. And then they had, back in the kitchen, they had a stainless steel refrigerator, and they kept sliced turkey and stuff in there. Oh, the temptation was too great. What was I saying that for? Oh, I got tired doing that. But the difficulties weren't too great. Now, the travail, the word travail is the word mokthon. Mokthon, M-O-C-H-T-H-O-N. Now, mokthon means labor fraught with difficulties. Now, Paul was a leather maker. I don't know anything about leather making. I don't know where the difficulties came. Maybe the difficulties came in collecting the bill from people. And leather making included a lot of things in those days. Saddles, same as today. Tents. All kind of garments and so on. His hands must have been gnarly and hard from working with leather and sewing leather and so on. Extremely difficult work. And it was not customary in that day to work at night. Those people had better sense. When it came nighttime, they quit and went home. Much more intelligent than 20th century people. They realized that nighttime was made to sleep. They weren't used to working at night. That was a non-customary thing. But the Apostle Paul wanted to be free in the daytime so that he could teach laborers and he could speak in the marketplace. And so he labored at nighttime. And apparently what he did was get up about 4 a.m, and while it was still dark, he would work at his trade. And he supported his whole evangelistic personnel on part of his second missionary journey by working with his hands. And then in the daytime, he would go and visit believers and teach them. Listen, he was only at Thessalonica. a maximum of could have been much over 6 months. Some people say six. I think about three, and maybe only there 3 weeks. He was teaching those people every day, meeting with them in little groups. And he did this so that they would not have to pay the bill, so that he could keep the gospel free in its initiation with a new people. It ought to be that way today. So he said, the means of our being able to keep the gospel free to you was by our own labor and wearisome toil. And it was tiresome and agonizing, but it had to be done. I'll tell you, Emmanuel Haynes is in for that. You better pray for that guy if you expect that work to succeed. I worked in Bible institutes for 13 years. I've run weed trimmer. I was a president of school and ran a weed trimmer half the time. We had a dormitory full of boys, and we didn't have any athletic facility. And I went down to the prayer meeting one night. I said, "You guys want an athletic facility? You want something to do around here?" "Yeah, well, why don't you start praying about it?" So they started praying, and pretty soon we got out there and started leveling with shovels. Did you ever try to level a basketball court? You know how big a basketball court is? I'm going to tell you, it's huge. And you try to level this Colorado clay, sitting out there in the foothills where the sun bakes it out like a rock. There isn't any water out there. You know, this Denver is arid. It's a desert. People are moving away by the droves from this place. Freezing in the winter, hot in the summer, no water. We went out there and we started leveling that thing by hand. Then we met a guy ran a road grader down the road for the county, and somebody says, "Hey, you know, boy, we sure could use your services over here. We're trying to level this court." He says, "I'll be glad to do it. I'll come over after hours." Brought the big road grader over there, came in here, took about 3 swipes with a blade and had the thing level. Then we had to build the baskets. We had to build it. Somebody gave us some drill pipe out of an oil well. And we welded the drill pipe together. We made a frame for the banking board. We built the banking boards ourselves. The only thing we bought were the nets and the baskets. And then Dr. Van Ben Scoten died and left $1,000 to our school and says, "I want it for the physical welfare of the students." And we poured concrete on the basketball court. You did that in your spare time between 6:30 at night and 10 o'clock at night, those kind of things. Well, personal illustrations. I've had it made so long since I come to Holly Hills, I'm ashamed to give them. I don't do anything anymore. Paul puts us to shame. Now, I'm going to have to qualify that, though. He knew what it was to be fully supported. On his first missionary journey, it didn't work at all. I'm going to share some of that information with you. Maybe next time we meet. Paul didn't have the attitude that he was working for God. He looked at his full-time occupation as of evangelizing. And he carried a full-time job, but he didn't look upon his ministry for Christ as a part-time ministry. Evangelizing was his life business. Making a living was secondary. He had no intention of making tents in order to better serve Christ. He made tents because at the time that he made them, it was conducive for proper communication of the gospel. And when he didn't have to make tents, he didn't make them. But I'll tell you, he puts a lot of us professionals to shame today. In half the places in this country, if a pastor went to work, everybody would faint. And then they'd think he was out of fellowship. They'd think the Lord had put him on a shelf. Well, that might not be the case at all. You know, I was reading this week a booklet, a magazine that was devoted to communicating Francis Schaeffer's story in Switzerland. You know, it's an exciting story, that man. He was a pastor in St. Louis, had a 13-room parsonage. And he felt the Lord was leading him to Europe to work with children. So he resigned his pastorate and went to Europe. He wasn't in Europe too long, and he decided working with children really wasn't his bag. And he felt the Lord wanted him to live down in Switzerland, but they were going to kick him out because his visa was up. And they said, the only way you can stay is if you buy a home. Well, he didn't have any money to buy a home. So he had determined by that time, he'd been in Europe 5 years, that his ministry was going to be totally dependent upon God. He wasn't going to be all the time begging people for money, and so he said, we're just going to pray about it, told his family. The money comes in, it comes in. If it doesn't come in, we don't stay. We'll just take it as God's will. And over the next X number of days, when he had to have $8,000, $8,000 came in designated without him telling anybody. It came in designated for him, for quarters for him. I think it was something like 61 cents short of the amount that he had to have. Now, the normal attitude would be the guy was probably out of the Lord's will. There he was sitting over there in Switzerland, wasn't doing anything. Maybe the Lord put him on the shelf. Well, look at the ministry the guy has now. 19 books published. He now has 9 chalets where students and dope addicts and people that are disoriented to life and intellectuals go to hear Francis Schaeffer teach what Christianity is. He now has another home in another town where he lives. He doesn't even live there anymore. All of his kids are involved in the ministry of Leah Bree. Just a beautiful story. Well, let's move on. We have to. For you, brethren, remember our labor and travail, for laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable unto any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of God. You are witnesses. Now that's one side of the coin, for people to be witnesses of your life. It's possible, however, to so conduct our lives, we can control our actions while around people and leave impressions with them that we are one thing when we are another. Now, you cannot control your reactions to things, however. People are around you and they see you react, and they know how to read reactions, and they'll know what you are. You can't be a pastor for 5 years with a people without them knowing what you are. They know all your weaknesses. They know your strong points. They know your downfallings and your upsittings. And probably know a few other things you don't know about you. Paul says, you are witnesses. That's the people. But then he says, God is also a witness. And God sees things that people don't see. He sees our heart and our mind and our frame of reference. And Paul says, here is what you saw, and here is what God saw about me. You saw and God saw how holily, how justly, and how unblamedly we behaved ourselves among you that believed. The holiness is indicative of what God saw. The justness is indicative of what men saw. And the blamelessness is the verdict placed upon the behavior of Paul and his evangelistic party. And so he says in verse point 4, in defending his actions, he says, our lives backed up what we preached. I didn't preach against going to the movies and then stay at home and watch the midnight movie on Saturday night or Sunday night. What I preached, he says, I backed up. Verse 10. The fifth point, and the last one in his defense, is an allusion to him acting like a father in verse 11. As ye know, how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father doth his children. So he says, our appeal to you was with three things, exhorting, consolating, or consoling, I guess would be the right word. Consoling. Our appeal to you was attesting. These three things. Now he did this as a father does his children. Now incorporated then in that verse is some of the attitudes or some of the expressions that the normal father, that the healthy father has toward his children. The word exhorting means to encourage. Paul had a ministry of encouragement among the believers, just like a father has to encourage his son. Here is his son who's, let's say his son is 15. And he goes to pick up the milk off the table and he's 15 and he... Don't feel bad. If you're 15, you're on the way to being 16. Just feel like, you know, where do I fit in? I'm 15. Yeah, so clumsy. Everything I do is wrong. I can't do anything right. You know, this self-consciousness is really beginning to manifest itself. Well, Father encourages that kind of boy. Yes, you do things that are right. You do a lot of things that are right. So on. So he encourages him. He doesn't destroy his self-image, you know. The kid is working on the car with him, and the father says, hand me a 7/16 box-end wrench. And the kid hands him a 7/16 open end. I said a 7/16 box-end, you knucklehead! Aren't you ever going to learn what the difference between an open end? You don't beat that boy into the ground that way. You'll destroy him. Encourage him. So then he also, a good father, consoles. This means a gentle influence by words. Alright, let's say he is kind of clumsy. You say, that's okay, you're going to grow out of that. Look how graceful you are in a swimming pool. The word attesting is the word witnessing. Now that means to charge. In other words, as a father, even though you have to exhort and encourage and console, sometimes you have to charge. You have to say to a 16-year-old, 15, 17-year-old, no, you are not going to do that in my house. Period. Do you have it straight? Is the communication clear? No compromise on the issue. That ends it. That's it. Now, that's what Paul said he had to do with the believers. All three of those were part of his ministry. So in the context then, he has made allusion to acting like a mother and acting like a father. And that's exactly what ministry is all about. So he says in his concluding statement, why did we do this? We had a purpose in all of this. Verse 12, that you would walk worthy of God who hath called you unto his kingdom and glory. And Paul is saying, my personal attitude was, I did not want you to see something in me that would encourage you to walk in an unworthy manner. And I was careful and gentle and kind and loving. I was firm like a father when I had to be. And I did all of this with a view to your good, so that your conduct in life would be pleasing to God and to the Lord. This paragraph then is a defense of Paul's methodology and his ministry. It is also a model by which each of us can take exhortation, and particularly those who have the privilege of public ministry. Shall we pray? Please open your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 3. For you who are visiting, we are in a series in 1 Thessalonians. And the first two chapters of this book happen to be very personal. They are dealing with Paul's initial experience in the town of Thessalonica. He is reflecting on those experiences, upon the success of them, and upon some of his attitudes and motivations in evangelizing the town at Thessalonica. Now, in between the time that Paul had visited that city and the time that he wrote this epistle, which was approximately 1 year, maybe a year and a half, he had come under accusation by some false teachers at Thessalonica. And they had accused or they had impugned his motives in evangelizing. And though he did not like to talk about himself, he was forced to talk about himself. And so chapter 2 is somewhat of a defense, particularly verses 3 through 12. It is somewhat of a defense of Paul's motivation, actions, and message in his initial visit to Thessalonica. Now last week we saw the negative side of that defense. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 through 6, there is a sevenfold, it's somewhat of a negative defense, a defense expressed negatively. A defense expressed negatively, sevenfold. First of all, Paul says, verse 3, for our exhortation or appeal was not out from the sphere of deceit, nor was it out from the sphere of uncleanness, that would be moral uncleanness, nor was it in the sphere of guile or trickery. In other words, there was no deception in our appeal. There was no sensuality. And that word has moral connotations. He is saying there was no immoral motivation. There was no fraud. And the real word there is trickery. I didn't trick you into coming into the fellowship so you could hear the gospel. I didn't offer you a lollipop or promise you a watermelon feast after. We didn't use any tricks or gimmicks in our message. It was a straightforward thing. Thirdly, he was charged of being a sycophant. There was no sycophany, phony, fanny, fancy, psychophancy. Yeah, this means, sycophancy means a flatterer. A sycophant is one who is a parasite, and the way his parasitism functions, if that's the word, is that he flatters people. He's a chameleon. Everywhere he goes, he turns the color of the people he's with in order that he can sort of win them. He is so motivated by approbation lust that when it's green, he's green. When it's red, he's red. When it's black, he's black. And he's doing this because basically he is parasitic. He is a tail-bearer, a men-pleaser. Paul says in verse, all three of these are found in verse 3. In verse 4, he is not a sycophant. But as we are allowed of God to be put in trust with the good news, so we speak, not as pleasing men, but as pleasing God. And God keeps on trying our frame of reference, our hearts, the deepest resources of our spiritual and intellectual beings. There was no flattery in his message. found in verse 5. For neither in any time used we flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak of covetousness. Verse 6, no covetousness cloaked. Covetousness always comes as a cloak. Don't kid yourself about your own personal covetousness. Our covetousness as individuals, my covetousness, will always cloak itself. Usually it'll put on a religious garment. It'll act religious. And hence Paul says in Colossians, all covetousness is idolatry. People who are always using platitudes and pious expressions often are wearing a cloak of covetousness. Point 7, Paul says, there were no impure motives. There was nothing you had that I wanted. I came to serve, not to be served. In verse 6, he says, there was no seeking of material advantage from his point of view. Now, these are points that we covered last Sunday. So today, let me read verse 6. We should be ready for verse 7. Read verse 6. Nor of men sought we glory or praise, neither of you, nor yet of others, when we might have been burdensome. Now, that word burdensome means we might have been heavy. And the word really means we were heavyweights of Christ. We were apostles. And we could have made demands on you people, Paul is saying. But we would not do that. Okay? Now, in the next 6 verses, he is going to approach this same defense. By the way, he's being accused of all of this. And he's making this defense. This is why he's saying this. So in the next 6 verses, verses 7 through 12, we're going to have a 5-point positive expression of Paul's motivation in ministry. Okay. Now, I hope you're on board. We took a lot of time with announcements this morning, and we're about 10 minutes late. So let's move on, right? Verse 7. Now the positive expression. But we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth. And that word cherisheth means warms her children. And it's her own children. If you have a marginal reference, it'll say her own. Now the first aspect then of his positive expression about his means and motivations is, we, literally now, became gentle. Wait a minute. I want to look at that verb. I have the word became down, but it might be with the next verse. I might have written it in. Yeah, we became gentle. That's there. Okay. We became gentle as a nursing mother. This word became is the aorist passive form of ginomai, eginese. E-G-E-N-E-T-H-A-E. Now that is an aorist passive. From ginomai, it's an indicative verb. That's not overly important, just simply reaffirms the reality of the condition. The aorist tense is the tense of consummate fact. The important thing about this is the meaning of it. Ginomai means to become. And it usually means to become something you were not. Now, I don't want to read too much into that verb. But it appears to me that Paul is saying there was sort of a spiritual movement in my own personal life with you people. I wasn't necessarily that gentle maybe when I first came or first met you, but I learned to be gentle. If he uses ginomai in its primary meaning, that's what he's saying when he opts for that verb. So he is expressing this warmth that developed in his own personal life toward these people who had believed and responded to his message at Thessalonica. We became gentle among you. And then he used a metaphor. As a nurse. Now this word for nurse is the normal Greek word for nurse. It's the word trophos, if you're interested. T-R-O-P-H-O-S. But he qualifies the word by saying a nurse cherishing or warming. Cherisheth is a beautiful word. It's the word phalpo, P-A-L-P-O. And phalpo means to warm. Like a mother bird who takes her birdlings. What are baby birds? No. Fledglings. Is that a bird? Takes her birdlings. And in the nest, she opens her wings and flops those little ones in under her wings so that they all snuggle under there, and she warms them and cares for them. Very, very tender expression in that word. This is the great Apostle Paul who thundered the gospel and told men if they preached any other gospel to you, let them be damned. Let them go to hell. That same man is giving expression of the attitude that came to be his. The attitude that became his. And the passive, if you take this passive sense, then it means that God taught him that it was sort of brought upon him by an outward source. Passive means he was acted upon by an outward source to become something he was not. Tender and gentle. As a nurse. And this nurse is personified or identified as one with her own children. As a nurse cherisheth her own technon. Or techna, I guess it'd be in the plural. Now this word own, see, is a intensive pronoun, eautes, E-A-U-T-E-S. This means her very own. It doesn't mean some child that's entrusted to her, but her own children. Now we have some women in this church that are nurses and are mothers. I don't want to make a radical statement, but nurses usually make good mothers. Part of nursing is serving. Now, not all nurses love to serve. If you've been in certain hospitals in the vicinity, you know that all nurses do not like to serve. You kind of have to twist their arm to serve. And some hospitals, they love to serve you. It just seems as though, you know, they enjoy it. I don't know how they can enjoy all that bedpans and cleaning up the vomit and giving people bed baths. I don't know how they can enjoy that, but at least they act like they do, and they apparently do. The training for a nurse is excellent training for a mother. And the service that they have to render, if they learn to serve, which a mother has to do, the training is just excellent to be a mother. We have some in this church. Of course, the ones in this church are, they love to serve. They're excellent nurses and mothers. The word picture here is that a person who is a nurse but is also a mother, the way that she would care for a child expresses the attitude that the Apostle Paul had toward people at Thessalonica who were responsive to his message. Lavish, affectionate care. Self-sacrificing care. And he's going to tell us about that in a little bit. What it cost him to do that. And the care, you know, the concept is that care that a mother, having gone through this tremendous physical and biological and chemical change that her body goes through during gestation. And she begins carrying this life within her. and the identity that she has with that life in her womb. And then all of a sudden, after 281 days, 70 days, something, that child is born. And the tremendous trauma and shock that occurs to that physical body of that mother, and the emotional shock. And yet, if she goes through that conscious, or even if she goes through it unconscious, the moment that she is conscious, she wants that child. She wants that child next to her. And she has gone through probably the most traumatic physical and biological and emotional and mental shock of any experience on the face of the earth. And yet she's ready to care and nurse and love and hold and cuddle and warm that child. And in the days ahead, interrupted sleep, already her sleep's been interrupted. In the last month of pregnancy is a nightmare. Can't sleep, can't get comfortable, can't roll over, hasn't been able to roll over for a long time. Always go in the bathroom, pressure on the bladder. Can't get comfortable. Hasn't had any decent sleep. And yet, when she carries that child home from that hospital, and usually it's only 2 days now, three, she's going home to interrupted sleep, continual work, self-sacrifice, making sure everything's clean, cleaning the bottles, cleaning the diapers. Where do pastors get the idea that they don't have to change dirty diapers? Where do we get this concept of ministry where the pastor is the Lord of the flock? And he doesn't have to pat any heads and clean up messes. That's not a scriptural concept. You know, I've about had it with these soul winners that go around and have illegitimate kids all over the place. They never change a dirty diaper. They come around and tell you how many souls they won to Christ. Oh, I was over there and I won next soul. Reminds me of these people on welfare. They got bastard kids running all around. They're never a father to them. They don't support them. They don't take care of them. They got a bunch of kids running around. The Apostle Paul wasn't that way in his ministry. He stayed there and he was a father and a nurse for those young believers. And I want to tell you, he did change a lot of dirty diapers. And he did a lot of head patting and some butt patting too when it was necessary. And the concept of a pastor being a dictator, that originates or that stems from insecurity on the part of from his point of view. And a person who's involved in that type of attitude toward the pastorate does not understand spiritual gifts and how spiritual gifts should function in the church. Now, Paul had the attitude of a nurse, consoling, feeding, caring. And he did not have illegitimate fledglings running all over the country that he didn't care for. If he led them to the Lord, he cared for them. And that's what he's saying in this verse. And he's saying to those people, you know that's true. And I was like a nurse among you. Now, among you is not properly translated. All texts, including Textus Receptus, have in the midst of you. Now that speaks of his identity with them. He didn't live in some ivory tower where he didn't identify with the people who responded to his message. He did identify with them. He was right in the middle of them. And that statement is expressive of his total identification with these people, as well as his whole evangelistic team. We were gentle among you, even like a nurse warms and cherishes her own children. Now, in verse 8, I think that this initial participle in verse 8 is reflective of the kind of warmth that he shows, because he uses a word that is unique in the New Testament. It's the only place that it's found. It is not found in the papyri much. It's relatively scarce in all the documents that are in existence now, secular documents and sacred. So in verse 8, he's saying, "So being affectionately desirous of you." And what that literally says, here is the word. Let me show you that first. We do not know a lot about this word. Hi, maramenoi. This is a participle, a defective middle participle, acts like an active, O-M-E-I-R-O-M-E-N-O-I. Can't tell you a whole lot about the word because not a lot is known about it. But the word means to experience the depths, to experience the depths of affection. Now, I looked in all my commentaries. They argue about the source of the word and so on, but they say we don't know what it means. But we do know what it means, because it is attached, I feel, to verse 7. Who experiences the depths of affection any more than a mother with child? There absolutely is no affection like that on the face of the earth. Affection between a husband and wife is different than that affection. Husband and wife affection is extremely deep and ought to be growing all the time. But this type is a little different. So I think what Paul is saying when he uses this hamiramenoi participle, he is saying, so thusly being affectionately desirous of you. What does he mean, thusly? Like a mother with her child. Okay, he went on to do something else. So thusly being affectionately desirous of you, we were willing. Now, we're willing in verse 8. Is an imperfect tense. The imperfect tense is the tense of past durative action. Past linear action. It meant he kept on being willing. And the word means pleasing. We kept on being pleased. Now what did he keep on being pleased about? We kept on, because of this tremendous affection that developed, we kept on being pleased to impart unto you not only the gospel of God only, but also our own soul. Now that verse, of course, is a human relations verse. That's PR right there. That's genuine PR. He is saying we developed such an identity with you people that it just wasn't a pleasure to communicate to you the gospel, the good news. But we were willing to lay down our souls for you. Now the soul, as Paul uses it here, the soul stands for the man himself. The man himself as feeling and acting through the body. You see, your soul is designed to orient to life and to life forms. Here's your soul. This is your body. Well, some of you look that way. Some of you look a little better. This is the body. We'll let that represent the body. In your body you have mind. In your mind you have two banks in your mind. One bank is your soul. The other bank is your spirit if you've been born again. If you haven't been born again, your spirit is dead toward God. It is inactive. It is inoperative toward God. But the person who is regenerated is functioning, or has the potentiality of functioning on both banks of his soul, or his mind, his soul and his spirit. He functions on both banks when he is in fellowship with the Holy Spirit. Well, in his soul he has self-consciousness, he has personal awareness of himself. If he is properly oriented to God and to proper life forms, then he sees himself as a worthy, viable creature in the sight of God. He has a good, healthy self-image, part of his self-consciousness. Self-consciousness manifests itself in many ways. When we look at a group picture, we always look for number, and we know we're on there, we always look for number one. That's self-consciousness. You're aware that you are a person. And don't feel too guilty about it until you think that number one's pretty hot. Now that is self-consciousness controlled by the sin nature expressing itself as ego lust. That's all. But the fact that you think well of yourself means simply that you have a good self-image. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's very important. You cannot properly love. If you're a woman, you can't properly love a man unless you have a healthy, correct, accurate image of who you are and what you are. If you're a man, you cannot properly love a woman unless you understand who you are and what you are. At least there'll be inadequacies where there is deficiencies in these two viewpoints. We have mentality in the soul, capacity to think abstract thoughts, analyze, be critical. We have volition with positive and negative poles. We have emotions. We have senses. We have a conscience with norms and standards. And unfortunately, we have a sin nature in our soul, which is the perverter of the soul. Now, the soul is designed for proper orientation to life and life forms. The spirit is designed for proper orientation to God. The body is designed to function as a functioning instrument in an environment that is prepared for it, the cosmos. The problem is that our soul needs to be saved. It needs to be saved from our sin nature and from certain aspects, external aspects that impinge upon it, Satan and satanic forces, fallen angels, and so on, that try to communicate with our soul and often are successful. Now, Paul is saying, see, if you properly function as a believer, you function out of the resources of your spirit, out of what the Bible calls the inner man or the new man, the hidden man of the heart. If you are functioning properly as a believer, your motivation is not so much external as it is internal. And consequently, you begin expressing yourself through the facets of your soul, through your emotions, through your senses, through the decisions that you make in life, through the things that have meaning in your mentality, through your self-consciousness and the awareness that Jesus Christ is in you and that He is the hope of glory. And you begin to express yourself overtly, worship, love, affection to believers, identification in assembly fellowship with roots, giving, witnessing. When they take their proper perspective, they are come from the inside out and not from the outside in. You do not witness because Professor so-and-so in personal evangelism class said, we had to witness to 5 guys next week. I got 4 done. How many did you do? Like that guy at the filling station at Bob Jones University where I went to. He's pumping gas, and I had to witness to 7 a week. I was a graduate student. And I had to turn a report in every week. So I didn't have my 7 done, so this guy's pumping gas in the car, and I got out of the car, and pulled out a track, and I said, "Say, have you heard about Jesus Christ?" "Hell yeah, I heard about him 15 times today already." Proper witnessing comes from the inner man and the resources of the inner man, the strength of the inner man. Proper worship, giving, everything in the believer's experience that is expressed overtly. Now Paul is saying, I have become so identified with you people that I would lay down my soul for you. And all that the expressions of the soul that can be made, they're yours. Now there's a difference in the Bible between the soul and the heart. Parenthetically, the heart, in contrast to the soul, is the frame of reference of the mentality. The heart is the meaningful things of the mentality. It involves the spirit. It involves with everything that you incorporate into your computer in your mind that gives life meaning. Okay. So point number two then, in Paul's positive defense and expression, is this. Point number one was, he was gentle among them. Point number two, in verse 8, how did I express that? Did I say with gentleness as a nurse? With soul love, anyhow, that's what I have in my notes. With soul love. All right. Verse 9. Now some of the manifestations of this come, see. For you remember, brethren, our labor and our travail. For laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable unto any of you, we preached unto you the good news of God. So point three of his positive expression is freely. He preached the gospel. At great cost to himself. Freely he preached the gospel at great cost to himself. Now the cost, boy, pencils are burning. The cost is expressed by the two words, labor and travail.